So this morning I'm going to talk about the essay that I've been talking about for a while now called Genjo Koan. This is maybe the fifth talk I've given on it, and I gave a talk yesterday, and I'll probably be talking about it on it for a while. It's by Dogen, and it's from the 13th century. And very roughly, it's translated as, excuse me, my mouth is a little dry. Actualizing reality, revealing reality, actualizing reality, making reality come alive. And that's really what the koans in Zen are all about. They're about overcoming that tension in our minds between opposing forces and actualizing the reality, which includes all sides of everything, because it's just life. A side is something arbitrary that we create. And so actualizing means bringing it alive so that the sides are fluid. They're not really sides. They're snakes. They're snakes. So, yesterday I talked about a sentence, which I'm going to continue talking about today. I'm about halfway into this essay now. And the sentence I talked about yesterday was, when a person attains enlightenment, it is like the moon reflecting on the water. And the sentence after that, which I'm going to talk about tomorrow, the moon never becomes wet, the water never becomes destroyed. So, to review some of the things I said yesterday. So when Dogen talks about this, Dogen is a sort of a master. He's a master at wordplay. He knows Indian Buddhism. He knows Chinese literature, and he knows Japanese. And he got a classical education from the time he was like seven. He was immersed in Chinese, Japanese, and Indian Buddhist scriptures. I don't know how much Sanskrit he learned, but he seems to have learned some Sanskrit too. So, and then he had a Zen practice on top of that, or we should say on bottom of that, because that's really what this is about, is Zen practice, not being a master, having a clever mind. But he does have a clever mind. You know, he can't help it. Sometimes, you know, you're just clever. Sometimes you're just stupid. They're both Zen, aren't they? So, three ways in which he talks about this I'm going to talk about today. Two of them I talked about yesterday. About this expression, when a person attains enlightenment, it is like the moon reflecting on the water. The first one is, the moon in the water is just a reflection, just a construct, just a fabrication. Pretty for a while, but nothing to get excited about. There are lots of constructs that we lay on the water, that we lay on each other, that we lay on ourselves, but they're just constructs. No need to get your undies in a bunch about them, right? No need to do that, right? No need to, because they've just come from our imagining mind, which is anxious and sometimes overwhelmed and wanting to get somewhere. We're having a retreat now. This is our second morning of retreat, and some people are disappointed because they haven't gotten anywhere. And what they're trying to get to is here, but they haven't made it yet. Oh, how much longer is it going to take me to get here? Because it's hard to just be here. We always We're always someplace else. Most of the time, we're so acculturated to being someplace else. So yesterday, as an example of someone who was able to see that storyline, moon is just a mental construct, and live a full life in spite of it, I talked about this fellow, this Japanese priest named Ozawa. Priest Ozawa, Reverend Ozawa, Roshi Ozawa, who in World War II had his legs blown off. And, well, having your legs blown off is awful, but for a Zen guy or a Zen woman to have their legs blown off, when our central practice is what? Sitting cross-legged. What's left? What's left? So, Ozawa Roshi, we'll call him that. Ozawa Roshi took on Zen practice anyway. Took on Zen practice with full ardor. And he used, I've been talking in my talks yesterday, and last time I talked about four foundations of meditation practice, or four pillars. They're not foundations, they're pillars, they're things we actually do that come from the ancient classical tradition and manifested in Zen. The first one, paying attention, to focus yourself, to open yourself up, to deepen yourself, to see that the moon is just a reflection. It's just a reflection. But all those worries and concerns are just reflections in the water. And the four are, first of all, number one pillar, working with your physical sensations in your sitting meditation, in your walking meditation, using those as an anchor, whether it be your breathing or your posture or something else. Coming back to those, coming back to those, coming back to those. And then second one, encouraging words, referred to as mental dharmas in the classic literature. Saying encouraging words over to yourself. Positive mental dharmas, encouraging words, can be in the form of a mantra, can be in the form of just something like deep peace, or whatever, encouraging words. Third one, shikantaza, bare attention. Just bare attention wherever you are. Just be there. Just be with it. The smell, the sight, the taste, the green of the leaves, the shadow on his shirt. Just be with it. Nothing else. Bare attention. And the fourth one, questioning. Deep questioning. Questioning which has a focus. The focus is to go below the chattering that is so incessant. So incessant. And so bothersome. Except when we're getting what we want. But when we're not getting what we want, so bothersome. And so Reverend Ozawa Roshi, did too. He did the second one. He did the bringing positive mental dharmas into view. And he did the third one. Shikantaza, just bare attention. And I can imagine him, although I don't know the details of this, I can imagine him in his sitting, however he sat, maybe in his lying. And this is from his book. He says in his book that he every day imagined himself as being born now, with two good arms and two good eyes and two good ears. And by doing that, he was able to sever the traumatic memory that had been his shadow for so long. We all carry traumatic memories. Some of us little ones, some of us big ones. But the cord of traumatic memory can actually be severed by this practice. And it will. If you do it, it will. It will sever itself. And as we were talking yesterday, that severing can seem a little violent. Just like when you cut the umbilical cord. It's bloody. It's a little violent. Because we're so captured by that story. We're so captured by all these things we've been saying. And that we're continuing to say. That it's a little wrenching to actually sever it. That's why we need to do Zen practice. And we have four pillars to help us. When we fall over, we can just grab onto those pillars. Whatever one, any one is fine. All of them are fine. So that's the first meaning of Dogens. First meaning of when a person attains enlightenment, it is light, the moon reflecting on the water. The second meaning is that, if you know Dogen, you're not surprised at this. This moon being reflected in the water's real, but the moon's not. Well, what would Dogen say about that? He would say, oh, well, this so-called reality, this water, this great spaciousness, this great openness, this great enlightenment, that's a mental construct too, right? The minute it's here, it's a mental construct. The minute I say it, the minute you see it, it's a mental construct. And you get attached to that too, right? So everybody wants to get rid of the moon and just have the pure water. Well, is the moon reflecting the water, or is the water reflecting the moon? Or are you reflecting yourself? That's Dogen's question to his students. And it's not a question he's taking lightly. He's not being frivolous about this. He's trying to help us. Trying to help us get free from this entanglement that we incessantly get tangled up in. So he quotes the 4th century Zen teacher Daozhen, whom I quoted yesterday. Not 4th century, excuse me. 4th ancestor in the lineage, more like the 7th century. 4th ancestor after Bodhidharma. Daozhen says, days and nights, in walking, standing still, sitting and lying down, if you always contemplate in this way, this is just after he's given instructions for Zazen practice, you will know that your own body is like the moon in the water, the reflection in a mirror, the heat waves in a hot day, the echo in the empty valley. You cannot say it is being, because even if you try to catch it, you cannot see its substance. Then he pauses and he says, on the other hand, you cannot say it is non-being, because it is clearly in front of your eyes. It's clearly in front of your eyes. Clearly, it's always clearly in front of our eyes. When our eyes are not glazed over, we don't see it. But it's when they are glazed over, we don't see it. But it's clearly in front of our eyes. So, and yesterday I talked about how we take that belief or faith in the idea of some clear water, some great enlightenment, some wonderful nirvana, some God that we worship who is beyond form, some peace that passeth understanding, and we turn that into a religion. We make a religion out of it. We get, instead of seeing it as neither being nor non-being, instead of seeing that, we take the non-being and reify it. And I talked about Buddhism doing this yesterday, and I'm talking about it a little bit more. people think, oh, Buddhism doesn't do this. The other religions do this. Well, Buddhism has done this every time that it became aligned with the state. Every time it became the formal religion in Tibet, in Japan, in Sri Lanka, the Buddhists started making wars on other people. Or certain sects of Buddhists warred with other sects of Buddhists. So Buddhists are just as bad. Well, maybe not quite as bad because they didn't become the establishment in as many countries as Christians and Muslims did. Not that they didn't want to be the establishment, they just didn't make it. So be careful. Be careful. Pay attention. Please. Please. All of us. All of us. So this retreat that we've been doing is non-liturgical. That means there shouldn't be anything for people to argue about, to try to get right, to try to say, this is the true way. You should chant like this. You should do the Oryoki like this. There's no need for that. But human beings always want to create something. Always want to create something because they think they know the way. Dogen is showing us something a little larger than this. A little larger. A little more easygoing. Easygoing. And of course, Dogen is not the first guy to do this in Zen. This is kind of what Zen's all about. And before Zen, in early Buddhism, we find this too. We find it, and Buddha himself. And we have the teacher Nagarjuna. And a lot of what Dogen says in here is really based on Nagarjuna. We've talked about this. It's really, he was obviously a student of Nagarjuna, but he also had experienced this stuff for himself. Nagarjuna in the second century of the contemporary era. Naga means what? Serpent. Naga means what? Dragon. Naga means what? Snake. He's the snake man. Nagarjuna is the snake man. He is a serpent man. You guys have Superman. I've got Serpent Man. We can fight to see who's better, Superman or Serpent Man. But let's do it playfully. Let's do it playfully, okay? Let's do it with some kindness and some fun. Let's do it that way, okay? Serpent Man. So the serpent, the Naga in Buddhism, goes all places, up to the heavens, down to the earth, in the hell realms. The Naga has no particular form. The Naga is moving so quickly. But the Naga doesn't think it's quick. It's just life, you know. It's just life. So the Naga is not stuck to anything. It's just wriggling and weaving and wooving. But it doesn't think about it in particular. Heaven, hell, in between. That's Nagarjuna. Oh, actually, when you read Nagarjuna, well, we'll talk about that another time, I guess. Sometimes it seems a little bit dry. But that's another issue. If you take Steve Hagen's course, it won't seem dry. You go take his course. It only lasts 9 months. Only 9 months of weaving and wooving with Nagarjuna. So Nagarjuna says, like Dogen says in his first meaning, You cannot say that things exist. You cannot say that the moon exists. You cannot, in the water. You cannot say that it exists. It's just here. It's beautiful, but it doesn't really exist. You cannot say that things do not exist. Well, there's something glowing in the water, isn't there? You can't say there's nothing glowing. You feel the glow. It helps you feel calm, doesn't it? It helps you light up everything when the moon's full. You can't say it doesn't exist. Your ego, your images help you. They create a world. They create dreams. They create possibility. You wouldn't be here sitting if you didn't have a dream about opening yourself and living in stillness, living in compassion. That dream is wonderful. Please take care of that dream. But it's just a dream. It's just a dream. Take care of it, but don't reify it, okay? So, Nagarjuna says, you cannot say that things exist. You cannot say that they don't exist. And then he goes on in that vein for page after page after page. And Steve teaches this for 9 months. I think I better go over there and see how he does it. And Nagarjuna says, also, he says there is a middle way. There is a middle way. Well, Buddhism has a middle way, right? In the middle way, we generally think between austerity and indulgence, between asceticism and overdoing things, between sequestering yourself away from the world and being caught up in the world, between eating too much and eating too little, all these things, the middle way, which Buddha talked about. But Nagarjuna says, well, that middle way is okay, but that's not the middle I'm talking about. That's not the middle that Buddha was really talking about. You can do that. You can try to live the Socratic mean, the golden mean. That's cool. You know, follow the precepts. That's cool. Do that stuff. That's cool. But that's not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is avoiding the harmful extremes of being and non-being. The harmful extremes of being and non-being. That sounds abstract, right? But he's not talking about abstraction. He's talking about us. How we get caught by something and then we pull away from it, thinking that we need to stay away from that thing. And then we get caught by pulling away. Then we come back and it catches us again. Then we pull away again. And the middle way is between those two. Between being and not being. Because those are harmful extremes. They hurt us. They hurt others too. They hurt our friends. So that's the middle way for Nagarjuna. And Nagarjuna and Dogen seem to be on friendly terms, because Dogen doesn't refer to him, but he uses the same sequential way of talking about things that Nagarjuna does. And the third meaning of when a person attains enlightenment, it is like the moon reflecting on the water. The third meaning. Well, to get a sense about the third meaning, it's good to look at some other things Dogen wrote. And I thank Shohaku Okamura for having done some research on this. One thing Dogen did is he commented on the Sutra of Golden Radiance. This is an old sutra, an old Mahayana sutra from 1,200 years before Dogen. The Sutra of Golden Radiance says, Shakyamuni Buddha says, the true Dharma body of the Buddha is like empty space. Responding to things, it manifests its form. It is like the moon in the water. And then Dogen translates this from Sanskrit into Japanese, using a character for moon that also means full functioning. So Dogen's translation then is, Shakyamuni Buddha says, the true Dharma body of the Buddha is like empty space. Responding to things, it manifests its form. It is like full functioning in water. So, Dogen, as those of you who are familiar with him know, talks about giving ourselves to this moment, to this activity, whatever the activity is, whether it's working or playing or sitting or cooking or cleaning, giving ourselves to it. And that full functioning is the functioning of the Buddha. But the Buddha isn't a particular person. It's the life force. And Dogen says about this in his characteristic way, and this will confuse those of you who have not done Dogen much, but don't worry, listen to it anyway. He says, this full functioning is the full functioning of as-it-isness, just as-it-isness. He says, the as-it-isness of like moon in the water is water moon. It is water as it is, moon as it is within, within as it is. As it is does not mean to be like. Do you understand? As it is does not mean to be like. It's very important, very important. As it isness is thisness, concrete, definite, each and everything. Each and everything. Each and every activity. Each and every, even anxiety. That's anxiety. As it comes up, it's the full functioning of your life. And if you take care of it, something blooms right out of that anxiety. Because the fertility is in the as-it-isness. The as-it-isness is wonderful compost, whatever it is. You may hate it, but there's no place you can't find the compost. It's all composting. Some of it is hotter than others. Some you don't want to get close. Oh, that's too hot. Some is more odoriferous than others. Oh, that's too odoriferous. Sorry, this is what you got. It's what is. It's what is. And Dogen has an essay that he writes on the moon. He has an essay he writes on the moon, taking off from a poem. I won't talk about that. Yeah, he has an essay on the moon in which he says the moon is the self. Well, I thought there was no self in Buddhism. Well, of course, there is no self in Buddhism, but Dogen talks about the self. He says, the moon is the self. And what is the self? What is the self? Well, you know, in Buddhism we talk about dependent co-arising. Everything interconnected. Everything at this moment arising together and subsiding together. All life. So, Dogen translates dependent co-arising as relational arising, and he says that's the self. The self is relational arising. The self is appreciating and responding to all the elements that connect us on each moment. That's the self. Simple, huh? Simple, huh? Now, if you think a lot about it, it's hard, but it's really very simple. Very simple. And Dogen says in this same essay, moonlight swallows all things. All things disappear and become the contents of the self. So he's not trashing ego. He's just opening ego up. He's just softening the edges to open it up so that it embraces you and me and the lake and the people on the other side of the lake and the veterans coming home from Iraq and the veterans stuck in Iraq and George W. Bush. George W. Bush, don't leave him out. On and on and on. Right here. Don't have to do anything except actualize it. Let it come alive in your life. Let it come alive. How do we do this? Well, Dogen doesn't give us too much help on that. You read them over and over again, looking for the practical advice. And you get a little bit sometimes, but not enough for people who want something. Especially people who want to be good Zen teachers and have something to offer. What can I offer besides the moon and the water? Come on, Dogen. I got to give another talk. But he's afraid we'll reify it. He's afraid we'll turn it into the true way. And we'll miss this. We'll miss this. But he does give a few little tips anyway. One is he says, Zazen, 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 Zazen. But he tells you nothing about how to do it. Doesn't talk about any pillars. The pillars are there. He alludes them, but he would never talk directly about them. And then he does a couple other things. Well, he quotes Chinese teachers, and then he talks about what they say. And here he's quoting Pan Shan Baoji. Pan Shan Baoji, a disciple of Matsu, who lived in late 8th century. Matsu. Disciple of Matsu, the horse master, who had a tongue that was so long that he could touch his nose. That's all I know about him. I don't know anything else about him. But that's what Suzuki Roshi gave a talk on him once, and all I remember is that I do know a lot of other things about him. I forgot for a moment, but that's the main thing I remember. That's very relevant to my talk. So, Banzan, Panshan, Baoji. The perfect circle, so Dogen quotes this when he's talking about the moon and the water. The perfect circle of the mind moon is alone. Its light swallows 10,000 things. The light does not illuminate objects, neither do objects exist. The light and objects both cease to exist. What is this? That's the poem. So the perfect circle of the mind moon is alone. So this practice that we do, this Zen practice, we do it alone. And it's kind of lonely. It's kind of lonely. Just this sitting, facing a wall, having all our stuff come up. Hoping it'll go away, experiencing a little bit of space sometimes, but having it come back again. It's kind of lonely. But we can only do it alone. We can only do it alone. Because it's about going deep ourselves. And no one else can help us go deep ourselves. It's about clearing out ourselves. And people can give us tips, but they can't really do it for us. So it's something we do alone. We do it alone together because that's the way we encourage each other, by having a retreat together. Very few people can do a retreat by themselves. A few heroes. I've tried doing them by myself, and I lasted about 3 minutes. Well, once I lasted 3 hours. But with one other person, that encouragement is so good, so good, so nurturing. Just to have one person to sit with for 30 minutes a week can really help you. Even though you're both completely alone. You're completely alone. But you're interconnected. It's the relationship self. You're interconnected. You're alone in that interconnection. So when Buddha said, only I, alone and sacred, he meant only I, which includes everything. But you need to experience some loneliness first, some real loneliness. He experienced some real loneliness. Dogen experienced some real loneliness. Suzuki Roshi, Katagiri Roshi, real loneliness, which we want to run away from. Of course we do. Of course we do. So that's one tip. Second tip is the way he ends the poem. The light and objects both cease to exist. What is this? Well, that's his wanting us to really question everything. Even the idea that we should be questioning. Because Tim says I should question, or Buddha says, what? What? What's that? What's that should? What is that should? Where does it come from? What does it need? What does it want? Why is it so prevalent? What? So that's the fourth pillar of Zen practice, the deep question. Deep question. What just comes up when it's ready on its own. It goes away when it's ready. But without this deep questioning, probably you will give up on sitting at some point. Or maybe you won't even get started. So it's very good. It's very good. So I'd like to close by reading Jataka Tale. Oh, actually, I can talk a little bit longer. Maybe I won't close. But I'll read a Jataka Tale about called The Rabbit and the Moon. This is a Jataka Tale that Dogen would have obviously was very familiar with. So it's just another way in which the moon comes in to Dogen's teaching and Buddhist teaching. This is Ryokan's telling of the Jataka tale. The Rabbit and the Moon. It took place in a world long, long ago, they say. A monkey, a rabbit, and a fox struck up a friendship. Mornings, frolicking in field and hill. Evenings, coming home to the forest. Living thus, while the years went by. When Indra, sovereign of the skies, hearing of this, curious to know if it was true, turned himself into an old man. Tottering along, and made his way to where they were. You three, he said, are of separate species, yet I'm told play together with a single heart. If what I've heard is true, pray, save an old man who is hungry. Then he set his staff aside and sat down to rest. Simple enough, they said, and presently the monkey appeared. From the grove behind him, bearing nuts he gathered there, and the fox returned from the rivulet in front of him, clamped in his jaws a fish he'd caught. But the rabbit, though he hopped and hopped everywhere, couldn't find anything at all, and the others cursed him because his heart was not like theirs. Miserable me, he thought, and then he said, monkey, go cut me firewood. Fox, build me a fire with it. And when they'd done what he asked, he flung himself into the midst of the flames. This is what all the Jataka tales are like, you guys. So you may not want to read them. He flung himself into the flames. and made himself an offering for an unknown old man. When the old man saw this, his heart withered. He looked up to the sky, cried aloud, then sank to the ground, and in a while, beating his breast, said to the others, "Each of you three friends has done his best, but what the rabbit did touches me the most." So, I kind of don't know what to say about that. And I don't want you to get any ideas. But the relationship self doesn't necessarily think of giving a sacrifice. Doesn't even think of dying a sacrifice. Because what dies in relationship? What dies in dependent co-arising? Independent co-arising and falling. What dies? Dies. And maybe that's a good way to end. Good question for you to go into. If you want to go into it. If you want to go into it. So, are there any questions or comments?
But I think I heard Al Franken say that the middle way is located somewhere between the head.
Al Franken says the middle way is located somewhere between the head. Oh, is that true? Do you say that?
Like I said, I don't always get things straight.
I see.
And it can transport you into a state of samadhi.
Oh, all right. All right. Thank you. Well, we better invite Al over and investigate what his true understanding of this is, of the Dharma is. Is it the relational self, or is it just Al trying to be someone other than he is already? Anything else? If you don't ask any questions or make any comments, these guys are going to have to go back to just looking at a wall, which is fine with me, but you should know that.
I just want to make a confession.
Okay.
No, it's not going to be heavy. But when you spoke, about the whole subject that you spoke about, and I think maybe the last story reinforced my thought, I sometimes feel like a toddler with a clever mom that pulls out a key chain and starts to distract from maybe the to the mother more from the small problems that the father has, and says, "Well, look here, what could be? Here's that keychain."
Uh-huh.
Because some of the concepts are so aloof that it's it's sort of almost sometimes. Does feel a little bit like a mind game where you have the choice of maybe replacing the things that you really feel but that don't have the scope of exquisiteness that this type of concept has of making life and death two sides of the same thing, and how about we just become a snake and all that comes to mind. Very early stage and back in my diaper.
Well, that's cool.
Yeah.
Great. You go back even farther. Thank you for your confession. It's a wonderful confession. Same for me. That's what I was saying a little while ago, that I wish I were a different kind of teacher than a Zen teacher, because then I could give you something. Even a different kind of Buddhism, where there was the 8 steps and the 32 thises, and you do this and that and the other, and you evolve, right? Ooh. But then the fluidity in our relationship would be dammed up a little bit by this stuff I was giving you, and the stuff you were absorbing or not absorbing. It'd be dammed up a little bit. Yeah.
And you said that Dogen didn't prescribe these 4 pillars.
Well, not directly. Dogen talks about shikantaza. Bear attention. So he talks about the third one all the time. He talks about questioning all the time. But he just does it. You should investigate this. You should look into this. You should inquire into this until you discover what it is or what it is not. So he's provoking you all the time, but he's not talking about it as a practice. The first one, the physical sensations, he doesn't say anything about those. About working with your breath, about working with your posture. Although he says to sit straight and think non-thinking. Oh, great. That's helpful. So he doesn't use the first one. He uses bare attention a lot. He uses questioning, but not as a technique. Just coming out of what he's, and the positive mental dharmas, the positive mental thoughts. He only uses those in the context of the ritualization, all the chanting that goes on in a traditional Zen monastery. So in a way, it's the day is full of those, but they're not talked about as pillars. You just do them. You chant about letting go of your past karma. You chant about vowing to help all beings, as we do here. So it's full of that stuff, but he doesn't talk about it. Does that make sense? Yeah.
You mentioned that you used the phrase damming up before.
Pardon?
You used the phrase damming up, the instructions and so forth, of damming up what we could obtain from our practice. We had precepts and so forth. And I wanted you to go back to that, but there's different aspects.
Okay.
On the imagery of the water reflecting the moon.
Uh-huh. Yes.
And so my biggest challenge when I've been on retreats is going back to those stories and those roles and having that be the damming up and the distortion that eventually takes me away from the retreat experience. Can you speak a little about those relationships as practice?
Well, a lot of people feel that way. A lot of people go on a retreat, well, if they have a good experience, but not everybody has a good experience, but if they have a good experience, if they get kind of cleared out and relatively still and relatively out of their obsessive compulsive mind, which most of us have, you don't need to be diagnosed. We're all diagnosed. From Buddha's point of view, we all are. And then you go back, you're thrown back into your other world where you have to do these things you don't necessarily feel good about. You've got a deadline. You'd like to stand and look out the window at the leaves, but you've got 30 projects that are due tomorrow. So that a lot of people experience that. And that's natural. And that division occurs naturally, but gradually that division can fall away. And how it falls away, I don't know. Just through doing this, and through doing some carryover in a daily life, some positive mental dharmas in daily life. Whatever you do, to say to yourself, maybe you've got 30 projects due, and you just remind yourself, I can breathing in and breathing out between each project, or every 5 minutes. I've had friends who set timers, and every 10 minutes they would. Well, they did this. They were serious practitioners, really serious. Every 10 minutes, when the timer rang, they would breathe in and breathe out for 30 seconds. or when they're eating, turn the radio off and say to themselves, "Just eating," and enjoy each taste: spinach chewing, sandwich. Instead of gulping the sandwich, my wife says I always gulp my food. She said, "You learned that with hanging out with those Zen people." She said, "That's not what Zen's supposed to be about." Well, in the old days in the Zen monastery in California, we had like 13 minutes to eat our food. That comes from Japan. So, but anyway, there are so many things you can do, but it's also better not to make a religion out of those things, because then you begin comparing and worrying and criticizing. So just take a few little things, breathing or tasting, and insert them into your life. We always have to do that. I have to do that still. But I let them sort of come rather than trying to measure whether I'm doing them effectively. But ultimately, there's no gap. There's no gap, because the moon is reflected in the water everywhere. Even there at 3 a.m. on the assembly line, in a temp job where you're going to get laid off tomorrow, the moon is reflected right there. But that's the moon in sense of the relational self. You're in relationship. Everywhere you are, you're in relationship. And if you can just slow down a little bit and see that relationship, then you get some great joy taking care of it. The joy comes up. It's not Tim's joy. It's just the joy of being there with it. Yeah?
Can you comment on the fourth commandment, the deep question?
Oh.
There's something about questioning that's so problematic.
Ah.
In that, we know questioning in terms of asking a question and have an answer.
Uh-huh.
So, 2 + 2 equals what?
Right.
And so you create an object and you have an answer.
Right.
And it seems like that's certainly wrong.
Uh-huh.
In Zen.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also the quality to question that, you're just goofing off if you're not probing the deep question.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Which is also wrong.
Yeah.
So the whole issue of deep questioning is one that you're attempting to do without. I mean, basically, you want the question more than you want the answer. And the problem with it is I don't think we really know how to do it.
Mm. Mm.
We know how to act with 2 + 2 equals 1.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. Could you guys hear him? Oh, but I'm not going to repeat that whole question. Let's see. Do you want to just summarize it for them in a loud voice?
Well, is the problem questioning in that we know how to ask a question when looking for an answer, but I don't think an answer is necessarily something that you're looking for when you're asking a question and then. And if you're not asking a question, then you're sitting on the cushion trying to feel good.
Okay.
Which doesn't seem to be the right activity either. So, and we also are trained that answering questions is extremely valuable.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, this is a good good subject. Thank you. So.
And in relation to that, I was wondering about contemplation. When Rev Anderson was here, he used that word, you know, rather than questioning. And contemplation, to me at least, means you're not necessarily you're chewing on something. Which is closer to what Bill's talking about, rather than expecting.
Well, there's two types of questioning. One is when you really need an answer. And the other way of questioning is that you ask yourself a question and you don't look for the answer and you wait for it. So one's we want to be active, but it's a passive way of asking a question that isn't really passive. There's something funny here, that's all. I don't know, contemplation is tricky too.
Can I ask a question? I'm looking for a path rather than the answer. I'm looking for the finger that points to the path. When you're not looking for words, right? When you're not looking for something concrete. You're just looking for a direction to look in.
Yes.
One thing that's really helped me is to look at it as if I'm subtracting answers. And that way, I think we sort of just naturally, the questions kind of just come up on their own without any conscious effort.
Through subtracting answers?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Say that again.
The way I've sort of evolved. In my meditation practice, it's sort of a process of subtracting the answers. That very process, of course, will sort of have a question naturally arise, and the whole purpose of not having a question is sort of the subtracting of the answers. It sounds abstract, but...
Yeah. Well, that's good. So this fourth one, I have to say, I almost didn't talk about it when I first thought I'm going to talk about the three pillars, and I thought, well, I'm going to talk about this fourth pillar. But the reason I almost didn't talk about it is just this, it's the reason that I'm not comfortable with a lot of Rinzai Zen. Well, some Rinzai Zen is great, but a lot of Rinzai Zen, the whole point is on having a question and then getting through that question. And that's a lot of reification taking place. That's a lot of, well, I got to have a question. I got to get through this question. I got to show the teacher. So for that reason and this reason of sort of what is this questioning all about, I hesitated before talking about this. Nevertheless, whether we call it contemplating to me seems a little more, not quite as hungry. I mean, there needs to be some hunger. Reb Anderson may have reached the point where he can just contemplate. That's cool. But there needs to be some hunger and probing about who we are, how we can have some calmness, to give our practice sharpness. And we should not be satisfied with any answer, because any answer is just a reification. We should just keep going, but we shouldn't should it too much. We should let it happen. And if you're just sitting and you feel kind of dull, then that's fine. Don't worry about it. Don't look for some artificial question. The fact that you're here this morning means you have something you're going into. I mean, you weren't raised in this religion. You came to this center or another Zen center because you wanted to open up, to explore more deeply who you are. You had some question. Maybe question isn't right, but not question that we can confine, but some question. And you still have it. Or you would have gone to sleep in my talk. You would have gone to sleep. Well, a couple of you maybe did go to sleep, so that's okay too, because don't try to always have this big question. That's fake. That's fake. Just let it happen. Just let it happen. And that questioning means that leads into bare attention. Naturally, it leads into bare attention, especially if you're not glomming onto any answer, because it's just probing, it's just opening in that questioning. But if you don't want to call it questioning, that's fine. Contemplation is fine too, but I want to just give you a little push and say, you know. Does that make sense? Oh, we got. Oh, these guys will never have to go back to sitting. Okay. I know. Oh, uh-huh.
That's one of my favorite. You answer all my questions, but it says, no, you question all your answers.
Oh, that's pretty good.
The Sanskrit word for rabbit is...
The what?
The Sanskrit word for rabbit is also the same as the word for moon. One of the
Oh, so that's where Dogen got this.
And it refers to the rabbit you see. When you see a full moon, you see the black rabbit.
Hey, good for you. See, there... Dogen has these layers that I don't even know about. Cool. Thank you. Anybody else? Ben.
Last night, a great storm obscured the moon. Moving across the lake, hard-driven droplets. Each drop shows bright lightning in the wind. Look for it. This reflection can't be found.
Thank you. Anybody else? Wanda. Right. Mm-hmm.
It's not always easy to know when you're caught.
That's right.
I mean, it's very easy to say, oh, I'm not caught, I'm just wondering.
I'm just sweating?
I'm just checking this out.
Yeah, right. Yeah, uh-huh. That's right. You know, it's elusive, and it's elusive. Elusive since we want to figure it out. If we stop trying to figure it out, it's not elusive. But we stop trying to figure out, then we often die. So stop trying to figure it out, but still just attend to it. It's not so elusive. There is that gap between non-being and being. Seems like it's only this big, but it's if the ant goes into the gap, the whole world is there. The whole world is there. And in these retreats, we have at some point we resume our ant nature. David.
Yeah, just keep your questioning going. Not a problem. There is a parallel tradition in Western monasticism that really I think keeps the questioning. Koans from being too much in the head.
Uh-huh.
It's called Lexio Divina, and there's four parts to it. The first part is reading the parable that has some kind of a multi-layeredness to it.
Uh-huh.
Reading it very closely. The second one is the chewing on it.
Uh-huh.
And coming up with what you're struck by with it. Well, how is it cracking you open?
Uh-huh.
And allowing that more that intellectual piece to crack you open. And then there's a prayer that you orate out of. And then silent contemplation from that, where you just let it go.
Cool.
And rest in the present.
Cool.
So it kind of keeps the ego out of it a little.
Uh-huh.
But you're not letting
Good. Thank you. Thank you. Could you guys hear her? Well, the inevitable is drawing near for the people who have to stay. Oh, the people who want to stay because they've got a burning question. Yeah. Oh, you wanted that poem again?
Just a question.
The question is, what is this? That's the question. But let's hear the whole poem again. The perfect circle. This is not the long tongue guy. This is his disciple. I'm hoping for a long tongue disciple. Hey, I got him. See, he was right here all the time. The perfect circle of the mind moon is alone. Its light swallows 10,000 things. The light does not illuminate objects, neither do objects exist. The light and objects both cease to exist. What is this? And on that...